Friday, December 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Over 300 kidnapped Nigerian schoolboys have been released. Plus, Sweden's king has harsh words for how his country has handled the COVID-19 pandemic.
Sweden has been an outlier in its national pandemic response, relying mainly on voluntary social distancing and hygiene recommendations to slow the spread.
And 2020 was a record year for journalists to be jailed. We'll have these stories and more next. More than 300 schoolboys who have been kidnapped in northern Nigeria were handed over to government security agents on Thursday. Katsina State Governor Aminu Bello Masari spoke earlier in a televised interview with State Channel NTA.
344 of the students have been handed over to security agents. I think we have recovered most of the boys, if not all of them. So we are making arrangements to transport them to Kaduna. Well, this news is reaching us about an hour ago, and the news has gone out that the children have been discovered and harmed, and all of them are on their way to Kaduna this night from the forest area of Zamfara State. And by tomorrow, we'll have them medically examined, and arrangements will be on the way to unite them with their families. But in the first place, all our boarding schools, we have fenced them and secured them. But what it means now, before school resumes, we must make sure working with the police and the other security agencies are sufficient and the security are posted to schools. In addition, on our own part, we are going to increase the number of the private security that we employ in each school to make sure that we don't experience what we have experienced in the last 6 days. Certainly, again, we are going to work with the communities that live around the schools to form another outfit of security that will help security agencies in the school and within the school premises to make sure that all is quiet and normal.
The December 11th abduction gripped the nation, already incensed by widespread insecurity, and evoked memories of Boko Haram's 2014 kidnapping of more than 270 schoolgirls in the northeastern town of Chibok. Sweden's king has offered sharp criticism of the nation's pandemic response, and Reuters' Maha Albadrawi has those details.
Sweden's king said his country had failed in its handling of COVID-19. In a criticism of a pandemic policy partly blamed for a high death toll among the elderly. Victoria, upstairs. In an excerpt from an annual Royal Christmas TV special, Carl XVI Gustav highlighted the growing impact of the virus, a rare intervention from a monarch whose duties are largely ceremonial.
It's simply, I think, that we have failed. Many people have died, and that is horrible. That is something we can all sympathize with. That we haven't been able to help them, and that is very sad, terribly sad.
The king's son and daughter-in-law tested positive last month. Sweden has been an outlier in its national pandemic response, relying mainly on voluntary social distancing and hygiene recommendations to slow the spread, while shunning lockdowns and face masks and leaving schools, restaurants and businesses largely open. The government's response to the pandemic was widely supported by Swedes in the spring, as they carried on much as normal while most of Europe entered lockdown. But the rising death toll, particularly among elderly residents of care homes, has drawn increasing criticism.
European Union member states will start vaccinations against COVID-19 in 10 days. This as Europe tries to catch up with Britain and the United States after what some have criticized as a slow EU approval process for the inoculations. Reuters reporter Soraya Ali is next.
States across the European Union will begin COVID-19 vaccinations in a matter of days, starting on December 27th. It comes as Europe tries to catch up with Britain and the United States in what some have criticized as a slow EU approval process. The start date will be almost 3 weeks after the shot was administered in England. Britain, which left the EU early this year, approved the shot for emergency use on December 3rd, followed by Canada on December 9th and the US Food and Drug Administration on December 11th. The world's first fully tested COVID-19 vaccination was developed by Germany's BioNTech and US company Pfizer. As a member of the EU, Germany is obliged to wait for the European Medicines Agency to approve the vaccine. On Thursday, German Health Minister Jens Spahn said Germany will start on December 27th if the approval comes as planned, before an online meeting with Chancellor Angela Merkel and executives from vaccine maker BioNTech. Italy and Austria also said they would start vaccinating on December 27th, the Sunday after Christmas.
Soraya Ali and Maha Albadrawi report for Reuters News. The French government says that President Emmanuel Macron has tested positive for the novel coronavirus and will self-isolate for 7 days in accordance with national regulations. During that time, he will continue to work and carry out his activities remotely. Other European Union leaders are now scrambling either to get tested themselves or to work out whether they need to self-isolate. Macron has had contact with many of them in the past few days. The World Health Organization announced on Wednesday that it is sending a team of researchers to China during the first week of January to investigate the origins of the novel coronavirus. Its spread has led to a global pandemic that so far has killed more than 1.5 million people out of over 74 million cases. The 10-member team will examine medical data and test samples to determine how the virus that causes COVID-19 jumped from animals to humans and where it originated. Most researchers believe the virus, which was first detected in late 2019 in the central city of Wuhan, originated in bats. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has appealed to rich nations to support the purchase of coronavirus vaccines for poor countries and refrain from hoarding doses for themselves.
We need to be able to make a vaccine available to everybody, everywhere, and affordable by everybody, everywhere. Now, to reach that, there are two things that are essential. First, to fully fund the COVAX, we have a gap of 5 billion. At the present moment, the activities are going on, but we have a gap of $5 billion until the end of January, and a global gap of more than 20 billion that needs to be addressed.
Guterres says that countries have an obligation to protect their citizens, but they cannot do so if others aren't protected and nature strikes back. As vaccines are being distributed, testing continues to remain important. Getting a COVID-19 test can mean long lines and delayed results. Matt Dibble looks into recent breakthroughs that may have more of us testing at home.
Though COVID-19 vaccines are on the way, health experts are cautioning that the need for frequent COVID-19 testing will be with us for a long time. Adequately testing the U.S. population has been a persistent challenge. Now there is hope for a new approach, self-testing at home. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
Rapid, sensitive, specific home testing, even one that you might not even need a prescription for, so that people can have within their own power to know.
Recent technological advances suggest that widespread home testing is within reach. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has authorized the first at-home COVID-19 test that generates results in less than an hour. Dr. John Chu of Sutter Health in California led clinical studies of the test.
It is essentially a lab test at home. on par or at least close to par as what we consider the gold standard PCR testing. There are enzymes in these solutions so that when the sample is placed, it amplifies the amount of genetic material that's there. The detector can detect it, and then within 30 minutes, a result will come out. How much nicer would it be for it to be able to be done at home and keep people isolated?
Chu says the tests will also provide an advantage when used in clinics.
When we can get results that are lab quality very quickly, we can help make decisions very quickly.
The company plans widespread distribution of the test in the U.S. this spring. Another breakthrough in testing comes from artificial intelligence. Researchers at the University of Oklahoma found that the cough of a person infected with COVID-19 has a unique sound signature that can be detected using AI, even in people with no discernible symptoms. Dr. Ali Imran led the research.
Then we built on that initial finding to try to create an app.
The app first had to learn to isolate a cough sound from all the background noise.
About 50,000 different type of coughs were used to train it, and then almost same number of non-cough sounds were used.
Then the app was fine-tuned using the coughs of COVID-19 patients. Similar research at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology shows AI can detect a COVID-19 cough with nearly 100% accuracy. Industry groups around the world have joined the race to bring cough-detecting apps to the public.
The beauty of this is that it is low-cost and it is repeatable, and it can be done every day, and it can be done several times a day.
In 2021, testing for COVID-19 may become just another part of our daily routines. Matt Dibble for VOA News, San Francisco.
The lawsuits against Alphabet Incorporated's Google continue to pile up, and VOA's Adam Phillips has that story.
Reuters News reports 38 states filed a joint antitrust complaint that accuses the tech giant of expanding its search monopoly, smart speakers, televisions, and cars. It is the third major lawsuit against the company. The federal case alleges Google made deals with phone makers, including Apple and Samsung, to make Google the default search engine. It alleges it is also using its Android operating system to pressure device makers to preload Google search apps and other Google products. On December 16th, another case was filed by another group of states led by Texas. That case alleges Google is harming competitors by engaging in false, deceptive, or misleading acts with its Google Ads product. Adam Phillips, VOA News.
And still to come.
It is the worst year on record for imprisonments, 274, because of primarily two reasons. One is the reaction to the global health pandemic, which has been met by the increased use of false news charges or fake news charges against journalists in retaliation for their independent reporting, and by a crackdown related to protests.
This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. British actor Sir Ian McKellen received a coronavirus vaccine on Wednesday as the UK continued its nationwide vaccination rollout program. The 81-year-old was given the recently approved Pfizer-BioNTech jab at Queen Mary's Hospital in London. Sir Ian said he was euphoric to be vaccinated against COVID-19 and insisted he would continue to wear his mask and social distance. Just a month after publication, Barack Obama's A Promised Land is well on its way to becoming the best-selling presidential memoir in modern times. Crown announced Wednesday that sales have topped 3.3 million copies in the US and Canada. Obama still has to catch up with his wife, Michelle, whose Becoming has sold more than 8 million copies in North America since coming out in 2018. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have shared a heartwarming photograph of their family, which features on their 2020 Christmas card. The image shows the royal couple and their three children at Anmer Hall in Norfolk. This is Lizzie Knight with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A decade ago, Arab Spring Revolution shook Middle East regimes, toppling a number of long-standing leaders once considered impervious to change. But analysts say the movement failed to meet popular aspirations for greater political freedom. Now, 10 years later, no new political order has emerged. Dale Gavlak has that story.
Massive Arab Spring protests swept away rulers in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Yemen 10 years ago. And in some nations like Syria, bloody civil wars have ensued, drawing in foreign powers. Jordan's former foreign minister, Marwan Moasher, says a decade after the Arab Spring, there is still little good governance in the Arab world as leaders fail to address popular demands for greater rights and rule of law.
The Arab world so far largely has refused to acknowledge that the old order has died, that the old tools it used, the carrot of financial resources and the stick of security services, are crumbling. These tools have to be replaced by inclusive decision making, by moving from patronage to productivity, by educational systems that prepare people to deal with the complexities of life, and by nurturing pluralism, respecting the diversity of the Arab world and understanding that it should be a source of strength and not weakness.
Moasher, now a vice president at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says perhaps with the exception of Tunisia, authoritarianism appears to be retrenching in most Arab countries. Kristen Dewan, a senior resident scholar at the Washington-based Arab Gulf States Institute, says the regional shift afforded by the Arab Spring provided the Gulf monarchies with an opportunity.
When they looked out across this region and just all these incidents of civil war or civil unrest and economic weakness, they sensed an opportunity to really expand their influence. In some cases, they felt even an imperative to intervene, to shape the region in a way that serves their interests. When you look at a state like the UAE, see really expanded ambition.
Moasher says that while it's true that the Arab Spring has not fulfilled its full promise for greater popular say, he argues that it would have been difficult to achieve a number of its goals within the course of a decade. It will take longer, he says. But the former Jordanian minister also warns that the clock has started ticking on authoritarianism. He believes that unlike their elders, Arab youth and this generation will not accept the lack of good governance, the main problem in the Arab world today. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
A French court on Thursday convicted an Islamic State operative in a train attack 5 years ago that was foiled with a dramatic tackle by three American passengers. Mark Mugallian is a victim and a passenger who helped thwart the attack.
I'm just glad it's over. I'm just glad it's over, and I want these guys to stay behind bars as long as possible.
The court sentenced Moroccan-born Ayoub El-Khazani to life in prison with a mandatory 22 years in prison. The European Union's top official says substantial progress on many issues has been made in post-Brexit talks, yet big differences remain to be bridged. Speaking after a phone conversation Thursday with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen added that bridging those differences, in particular on fisheries, will be very challenging. U.S. authorities are expressing increased alarm over a hack of computer systems worldwide. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
Officials suspect Russia was behind the sophisticated hack of government agencies, including the Treasury and Commerce Departments. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency says the intrusion poses a, quote, grave risk to federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial governments, plus critical infrastructure entities and the private sector. The agency warns it'll be hard to remove the malware inserted through network software. Sagar Magani, Washington.
United Nations humanitarian agencies are calling for a stop to the deadly sea journeys on smugglers' boats that are endangering the lives of Venezuelan refugees and migrants fleeing persecution and hardship there. Lisa Schlein has that story.
This appeal follows the latest loss of life in the waters near the Venezuelan coastal town of Giria several days ago. Up to 25 refugees and migrants, among them four children, whose boat had capsized offshore, were found floating in the sea. The shipwrecked vessel reportedly set sail for Trinidad and Tobago on December 6th. In the wake of this tragedy, UN agencies are calling for urgent efforts to stop smugglers and human traffickers sending refugees and migrants on dangerous sea journeys. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on authorities in Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago to launch an investigation into the incident. Mata Hurtado, spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, says both governments have agreed to do so.
Both governments have to conduct investigations, broadly transparent, and share their outcomes, and to cooperate between them, not only to solve, to understand what happened in this case, and to prosecute whoever needs to be prosecuted if they found the people responsible for it, but to avoid this tragedy happens again.
The UN Refugee Agency and International Organization for Migration report more Venezuelans have been leaving their country in recent weeks as COVID-19 lockdown measures in the region have eased. However, they note land and maritime borders remain closed, forcing them to escape using informal, dangerous routes. They say smugglers and human traffickers who exploit and abuse desperate people for profit are taking advantage of this situation. UN agencies say regular pathways must be available so refugees and migrants don't have to risk their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The number of journalists jailed for their work hit a record high in 2020, with 274 imprisoned globally. The annual survey by Press Freedom Organization Committee to Protect Journalists lists China, Turkey, and Egypt as the worst jailers. Unrest in Belarus and Ethiopia led to a surge in arrests, and protests in the United States resulted in unprecedented numbers of arrests. VOA's Press Freedom editor, Jessica Jarit, spoke to CPJ's Courtney Radish.
As details of a deadly new virus emerged in China, local journalists took to social media to report on it. In response, Beijing jailed them. Similar crackdowns on coverage contributed to a record 274 journalists in jail globally in 2020, data by the Committee to Protect Journalists shows.
It is the worst year on record for imprisonments, 274, because of primarily two reasons. One is the reaction to the global health pandemic, which has been met by the increased use of false news charges or fake news charges against journalists in retaliation for their independent reporting, and by a crackdown related to protests.
The pandemic adds urgency to the calls for justice for those detained. At least two died of COVID-19 in custody, and the family of a third, Kyrgyz journalist Azimjan Askarov, believe he also died from the virus.
In a global health pandemic like COVID-19, a prison sentence for journalism could amount to a death sentence for journalism because you can't socially distance. They don't have access to personal protective equipment. And of course, you know, prisons are vectors of infection.
The committee's data acts as a snapshot of journalists in jail on December 1st, but many more were detained than freed in 2020. In the U.S., more than 117 were briefly detained or arrested covering protests over racial injustice or related to the presidential election. Several still face charges.
Protests have always been an incredibly dangerous place for journalists compared to other beats. And really, it began when George Floyd died May 25th in Minneapolis, Minnesota. By May 26th, we saw our first assault of a journalist covering national protests. And by May 29th, the first arrest of a journalist. In all of 2020, we've documented 117 journalists arrested or detained.
Protests in Belarus led to an uptick in arrests, with 10 detained since the contested re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko. In Ethiopia, which more recently had shown signs of a more promising press freedom record, several were detained over coverage of unrest in the Tigray region.
Does Belarus and Ethiopia really want to join China, Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia on the list of countries that imprison journalists in retaliation for their work? I would certainly hope not.
In a year when access to independent news is more important than ever, the record number of journalists detained for their reporting is a concerning trend. Jessica Jarit, VOA News.
A powerful new telescope in Australia has mapped vast areas of the universe in record time. The Australian Square Kilometer Array Pathfinder was able to chart about 3 million galaxies in just 300 hours, 1 million of which have never before been seen. Phil Mercer brings us that story.
Galaxies are the building blocks of the universe.
From a remote corner in the Western Australian outback, a new telescope, which has turned radio signals in space into images, has examined the entire southern sky in sharper detail than has ever been done before. The Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder, 800 kilometres north of Perth, is run by the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, or CSIRO, Australia's national science agency. The telescope isn't just one dish or antenna, but 36. They're three stories high and connected by fibre optic cable, so they combine to work as one super telescope. The array is helping scientists study black holes, the nature of gravity, and the origins of the first stars. By cataloguing millions of galaxies, scientists hope to unlock the secrets of how the universe has evolved. Douglas Bock is the CSIRO's Director of Astronomy and Space Science.
If we can look at the statistics of them, where they are on the sky and how they interact with each other, then we learn about how galaxies like our own can form and how we came to be here on this Earth. And if we look at a galaxy that's far away, perhaps 12 billion light years away, we're looking back in time. So we're looking at the light from that galaxy that was emitted when it was only a few billion years after the beginning of our universe.
Researchers say the array's isolated location in Western Australia is ideal for this type of astronomy because it's quiet and far away from Earth-based radio transmissions. Much work lies ahead. The CSIRO estimates the universe could contain as many as 1 trillion galaxies. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting our website at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a fantastic Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Slovenia designated Hezbollah in its entirety as a terrorist organization, rejecting the false distinction between Hezbollah's political and military wings. As the Slovenian Ministry of Foreign Affairs stated, Hezbollah is a criminal and terrorist organization, posing a global threat to peace and security. The United States commends Slovenia for taking this step to help prevent Hezbollah from operating in Europe. Slovenia follows in the footsteps of a number of other European governments, including the United Kingdom, Lithuania, Latvia, Kosovo, and Estonia, which have all taken significant steps to designate, ban, or restrict Hezbollah in the past several years. Established in 1982 by the Iranian regime, Hezbollah developed a malign network encompassing political, military, terrorist, and criminal dimensions. Hezbollah established a powerful terrorist force with tens of thousands of combatants reportedly armed with some 130,000 rockets and missiles. In addition, Hezbollah set up an international terror and criminal network spanning from Latin America to Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. Hezbollah has a long history of terror and terror-related strikes against European interests. Since the 1980s, it has conducted a series of terror attacks against European targets in Lebanon and in Europe, including in France, Spain, Germany, Bulgaria, and Cyprus. Hezbollah has established an extensive infrastructure for terror activities on European soil and operated criminal financial networks across Europe, including drug trafficking, money laundering, and cybercrime. Hezbollah even deployed its operatives to fight in the Bosnian War in the early 1990s. The Trump administration has engaged diplomatically to persuade the international community to take a clear-eyed look at Hezbollah's malign activity and take action to prevent Iran-backed Hezbollah from operating in their territories. We've placed particular emphasis on Europe, noted Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement, and the State Department-led diplomatic campaign has yielded results, with 6 European countries imposing restrictions on Hezbollah over the past year, and other European governments considering new measures. The United States welcomes these steps by Slovenia and other European countries as progress towards ultimately eradicating Hezbollah's presence on the European continent.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.